Our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He received his MD from New York Medical College. He is board certified in general surgery and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Singer writes and lectures often on regional and national public policy, and his articles have appeared in such publications as the Washington Times, Investor's Business Daily, Reason Magazine, Liberty, the Arizona Republic, Arizona Daily Star, and Tribune newspapers. He is a member of the board of directors of the Goldwater Institute for Public Policy Research in Phoenix and is adjunct scholar at the Reason Public Policy Institute. He is treasurer of the U.S. Health Freedom Coalition and was treasurer of Arizonans for Healthcare Freedom, sponsors of the Arizona Healthcare Freedom Act, which the voters of Arizona approved in November 2010. It's extremely important, and I'm sure he's going to go over that. He is in active clinical practice as a general surgeon in the greater Phoenix area. Please, let's welcome Dr. Singer.
Thank you. I get to bring up the rear and be the anchor man today. I've been asked to talk about the Healthcare Freedom Act that the whole movement started actually in Arizona. And I guess the story of the Healthcare Freedom Act is really a story of positive unintended consequences, and you'll hear what I mean in a minute. The idea first came into being at a Starbucks on the corner of Tatum Boulevard and Shea Boulevard in late 2006. Dr. Eric Novak, who's an orthopedic surgeon in Phoenix, and I were good friends, and we're both activists and free market advocates. He was very disturbed after RomneyCare was passed in Massachusetts. California, those most people here from California, they were talking about a single payer initiative. The Democratic leader in the Arizona Senate was proposing a single payer bill in Arizona. So he had told me that when he was reading through some history, he discovered that one of the founders of America, one of the founding fathers, Benjamin Rush, who was a doctor and is believed to be the father of American psychiatry, he proposed during the debate over the Bill of Rights that there, one of the Bill of Rights be protection of medical rights, because he believed that without a protection of what he called medical rights, eventually what he called the medical dictatorship could develop as the profession becomes politicized and also prone to political rent-seeking. Well, obviously back in the 1790s, probably most of the people thought that Benjamin Rush was just kind of too focused on medicine, being a doctor, and he was getting a little alarmist, so he didn't get his way. But my friend, Dr. Novak, said, you know, maybe it's not too late. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, maybe we can get an amendment to the state constitution protecting our medical rights so that they don't do something stupid here in Arizona like they just did in Massachusetts and they're trying to do in California and several other states. So I thought, you know, you're onto something. We got together with some people from the Goldwater Institute, on whose board I sit, most notably Clint Bolick, who's the director of litigation for the Goldwater Institute. The Goldwater Institute has a litigation arm. Clint Bolick was one of the co-founders of the Institute for Justice years ago. We got assistance from Sally Pipes. We consulted her and got her input, and several other people, and we designed what was then called the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. And that's because we did a poll, and we believe that when we ask people what's more important to you, choice or freedom, the word choice polled better. So we decided to be a little fancy and call it the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. In any case, Arizona is a relatively inexpensive state to get a proposition on the ballot. So it cost us about $500,000 of fundraising, and we got enough signatures to get on the ballot for the 2008 election. And that's when we stopped raising money. We became very difficult. That's when we sort of hit a wall, because of course the presidential election was heating up, and most people who were about to give money for political efforts were much more interested in giving to candidates. So, and we weren't considered at the time that urgent. Remember, our entire focus was preventing Arizona from doing something dumb like they did in Massachusetts. Now, during the course of our campaign, and we had very limited means, so most of it was trying to use what they call free media, get interviews, get on talk radio, internet. Sometimes the question would be asked, well, if this thing was to pass here in Arizona, what happens if they pass some sort of national health care bill? Wouldn't that basically preempt anything we do here in Arizona? So we went back to Mr. Bullock, who was one of the nationally recognized constitutional legal scholars, and asked him, what do I say to people who ask me that? And he said, well, tell them that actually there's a strong case to be made that we would be able to get exempted from some National Health Care Reform Act if this was in our Constitution. And, for example, back in the 1990s, Oregon voters passed physician-assisted suicide. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court found for Oregon because on 10th Amendment grounds, the traditional police power of the state pertained to health care, and if it was in the state of Oregon's statutes or constitution dealing with physician-assisted suicide, then the federal government really had no jurisdiction in that area. So we could make a strong, of course, with the caveat, you never know how a Supreme Court is going to come down, but we could make a strong case that we would be exempt from a National Health Care Reform Act if this was in our constitution. So you could tell people that. So we did, but it didn't come up too often because, remember, the main intention of our act was for Arizona. And we thought it was obviously we thought other states should consider doing the same in their states. Well, because we didn't get enough money, we basically had a word of mouth campaign. We were opposed by AARP, by all of the unions in the state, and by all of the usual left wing groups. Despite that, in 2008, we lost 50.1 to 49.9. Actually, it took about 8 days after the polls closed for us to know if we won or lost. It was a real heartbreaker. Less than 8,000 votes out of 2.5 million votes cast. So we didn't know what to do after that. Some people who had turned us down when we asked them for funding called us and said, you know, I really feel bad. I should have helped you when I saw how close that was. And we what could I do to make it up to you? Well, you could, before people forget about this, maybe you could underwrite a poll now so we could see why people didn't vote for the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. And we were able to get some generous contributions, did a poll, a real good poll. We found, and of course, 70% didn't vote for it because they didn't know what it was about. And this being a proposition state as well, you know that the default vote is no if you don't know what it's about because, you know, if you vote no, then nothing's different than it is now, and you know what things are now. So that was the number one reason. We also found something interesting. Those who voted for it, we asked them, why did you vote for it? And the most common answer given was, I don't want socialized medicine. And further questioning made us realize that we were actually a little too cute calling it the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. The people who voted for it understood exactly what it was about. So we didn't have to be so delicate in our choice of wording. Shortly after the election in 2008, we could see the whole writing on the wall. They're going to try to pass what became known as Obamacare, affectionately. And actually, Arizona did very well in the election in 2008. Basically, we elected overwhelming majorities in the House and Senate of Tea Party people. And we lost our governor. She became the Secretary of Homeland Security. And in Arizona, we don't have a lieutenant governor. The Secretary of State becomes governor, and the Secretary of State was a Republican. So suddenly, we were the only, locally in Arizona, we had a good year in 2008. So we get approached by the Speaker of the House and the Senate, the chair of the Senate Health Committee, and they say to us, why didn't you come to us for help last year? Because, you know, this might be a defense against a national health care reform takeover. Well, you know, to be honest with you, we were afraid that if we went through you, because another way to get a proposition on the ballot is for the legislature to refer to the voters, which certainly saves you a lot of money and legwork in getting petitions signed. And we said, to be honest, if we went to you, we were afraid that by the time it works its way through the legislative sausage-making machine, it won't look anything like we wanted it to look like, so we decided to do it ourselves. But fortunately, like I say, this was a new group in the state legislature, and they said, well, you know what? We have our ways of making this work. So they actually sat down with some of their legislative counsel and with us and with our people from the Goldwater Institute who are giving advice. We actually improved the bill. They had some good suggestions. We tightened it up a little bit better, made it less prone to demagogic attacks from our opponents. And they overwhelmingly on strict party lines. What they did at the very last minute, the Senate Health Committee chairman did what they call a strike-all amendment, where there was some other bill. You'll see this copy of the bill is sent out. And the original bill that was already through all the committees and ready for a floor vote, the chair stood up and said, I am removing that bill and in its place putting this bill, with the exact language that we've had all along worked out. So it didn't go through the committees. And that's the way to avoid the sausage-making. And on a strict party lines, it passed. Then it went, actually, it was the House first, then it went to the Senate, and then it went to the governor, who signed it and endorsed it. So now we're on the ballot as Prop 106, the Health Care Freedom Act, for 2010. A buzz got started. Several people who belong to an organization called the State Policy Network, which is an association of free market think tanks, talked about what's happening here in Arizona. And a movement gets started to try to do the same thing in other states. In Virginia, the new governor and new legislature there, which was elected in 2009, they ended up taking verbatim Arizona's Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act that barely lost in 2008, and they passed it as a statute. Okay. By the time, in fact, the November 2010 election had come up, Idaho, Georgia, Louisiana, and Utah had passed the Arizona Healthcare Freedom Act as a statute. We were waiting for the November election. We were getting a little, in a way, jealous because, you know, this was our idea. We didn't have a chance to vote on it yet. But we were doing it as an amendment to the Constitution. Our legal experts tell us, obviously, statutes work too, but if it's in the Constitution, they believe when you're going before the Supreme Court, it's even stronger to defend. And then, of course, we have our election in November, and we passed very comfortably. I think it was 57-43. And so now it's a constitutional amendment in Arizona and also a constitutional amendment in Oklahoma. Actually, thank you. So what had started out as, like I say, unintended consequences, our original intention of this bill was for just local politics. But the advent of the 2008 election suddenly made the kind of the ancillary aspect of it, which was it's probably a good defense against national health care reform. That's what suddenly made it attractive to everyone and got a lot of support behind it, got a lot of momentum behind it. So meanwhile, it passed in Arizona. Since 2011, North Dakota passed it as a statute, Tennessee passed it as a statute, and I'm happy to tell you just at the end of the day yesterday, the Kansas Senate passed it. It's gone to the Governor Brownback's desk, and it will be, you know, he's going to sign that. So that'll be 9 states that have Health Care Freedom Acts as a statute and 2 that have it in their constitution. Now, sad to say, North Carolina's legislature passed it as a statute, but their Democratic governor vetoed it a couple of months ago. It's on the ballots in Florida and Wyoming for 2012, and it's very likely to be on an Ohio ballot this November 2011. Wow. Now, here's the other unintended consequence. Our entire plan was that if this gets, we wanted to be able to say to the Supreme Court that our Constitution protects a person's right to choose or not to choose to participate in any particular health care system and to make their own personal arrangements for how they're going to get their health care. Everybody has a copy of the amendment in front of them. And every state that's passed it is pretty much, with minor changes, passed the same exact language. So our defense is twofold. Number one, like I pointed out, this sort of 10th Amendment argument that the police power of the states pertains to health care, and if this is our constitutional or even statutory law, then the state takes precedence over federal. There's also a 9th Amendment argument. I don't want to get too arcane here, but those of us in this room who study the Constitution know the 9th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says the failure to enumerate certain rights should not be misconstrued to deny or disparage the rights retained by the people, which means just because we didn't mention certain rights in the preceding paragraphs doesn't mean that there aren't many other rights that the people that reside with the people inalienable. Of course, that's always presented a problem legally because since they weren't enumerated, you can get into big arguments over what is and what isn't a right. So an argument can also be made, well, clearly one of those unenumerated rights is the right to make your own choices about health care because several states have chosen to protect that unenumerated right in their constitutions. So that's going to be another argument. So that was the intentional use of the Health Care Freedom Act on the national level. But here again go the unintended consequences. Before we even had our election in 2010, the governor of Virginia, using his state's now passed Health Care Freedom Act, as you know, sued the federal government on the grounds that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. And one of the arguments that the opposing side put forth is, well, you don't have standing to sue on the grounds of the individual mandate. It doesn't even take effect until 2014. So what are you bringing this up for right now, number one? Number two, what is this in the state's business? So the governor of Virginia said, well, actually, we have a statute saying that a person can't be forced to participate in a health system if they don't want to. So we do have standing because you just passed a law compelling our citizens to participate in a health system. That argument gave them standing and allowed them to go forth and, of course, win on a district level. I'm not optimistic on the appeals court level, but it'll go to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Florida filed suit on individual mandate and on they also had a complaint regarding 10th Amendment issues, which is that Obamacare is forcing states to spend more money on Medicaid, and that's usurping the legislative authority of state legislatures. Well, they were going to have problem having standing to file their suit because they don't have any statute. They haven't yet passed the – actually, their legislature referred it to the ballot, but their Supreme Court threw it off on a technicality, so that's why it's now on for the next election. Fortunately, they were joined by 25 other states, including Arizona, Oklahoma, Idaho, Georgia, Louisiana, Utah, Missouri, and not Virginia because they have their own suit. So the court said, well, many of your co-plaintiffs have standing, so we're going to let this case go forward. So another unintended consequence of the Health Care Freedom Act that we didn't kind of notice, but it's a benefit, it's worked to our advantage, is that it's given states standing when they want to challenge Obamacare and eliminates that argument. So now we wait to see, you know, how it goes to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, in Arizona, not only did Arizona join that suit in Florida, but the Goldwater Institute filed suit, and we're waiting, actually, hopefully next month, Judge Snow of our district court in Phoenix will hear the case. And we're optimistic. Judge Snow is a George Bush appointee. So far, it seems it's all political, whichever president appointed which judge. But, of course, we're with you in the Ninth Circuit, unfortunately. So we know the appeals court will probably overturn our district court decision, and we'll go to the Supreme Court. But now we have a different case. Our case is two things. First of all, we're the only case to our knowledge that has noticed this. As soon as Obamacare passed, the legal team at the Goldwater Institute started pouring over, looking for something that other people haven't already found because we don't want to be redundant. And we found a very good reason to challenge Obamacare on the IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which, of course, takes effect in 2014. It's 15 presidential appointees who will decide what will be covered, what won't, what reimbursement rates will be, what they won't be, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, a death panel. And to make it so it's not subject to political pressure, in the legislation it says that any decision that this IPAB makes can only be overturned by a two-thirds majority in each House of Congress, that any decision it makes is not subject to judicial review, and that after 2017, the IPAB can never be repealed. Now, I just told you three things that are unconstitutional. And the Goldwater Institute is apparently the only people who noticed this. So that's one. So the plaintiffs in our suit are Congressman John Shattuck, he's just retired, who's now a fellow at the Goldwater Institute, Congressman John Shattuck, Congressman Jeff Flake, and Congressman Trent Flax from Arizona are plaintiffs arguing that this Congress cannot compel a future Congress as to two-thirds vote, whatever. That's up to each Congress to decide the rules when they have a vote. So it's unconstitutional. Number two, you can't pass a law that's not subject to judicial review. That's a violation of the separation of powers doctrine. And number three, you can't pass a law that you can't repeal. So that's one part of our suit. The other plaintiff to our suit is Nick Coons, who's a small businessman in Tempe, Arizona, who is self-insured, meaning that he just has enough money saved. He pays for his own health care privately. He would like maybe one day to consider buying a very high-deductible catastrophic policy when he has a family. But, of course, Obamacare forces him to buy health insurance and will actually bar him from having that kind of high-deductible catastrophic policy available to him when he would want it. So he is a plaintiff saying the individual mandate is unconstitutional because Arizona protects his right to not have to play in this game. And we, of course, cite these arguments that we originally intended to use. Interestingly, the feds have already responded to our complaint, and they took on the Arizona Healthcare Freedom Act, saying that it is that is not allowed because the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution gives federal law precedence over our state constitutional. That's exactly what we wanted, because we wanted to have this discussion. So the only thing that's unfortunate is that we're sort of late in this thing. By the time our thing makes it up to the Supreme Court, it'll probably be 2013. By that time, we would hope the Supreme Court will already have decided on the Florida and Virginia cases and maybe a couple of others that have been consolidated. So if the Supreme Court overturns Obamacare, then our case becomes moot. That's a nice problem to have. We'll remove our case. If they find parts of it unconstitutional and parts of it not unconstitutional, then we come along as a second wave. But in the meantime, the Healthcare Freedom Acts seem to be a really effective means of, on the state level, in those states where you can pass it as a proposition, or other states where you can work on your legislature to try to pass it as a statute, where you could mount a resistance through the courts to Obamacare. I was asked to comment on whether or not I think that's possible in California. I do not think it's possible in California. With this legislature, this governor, I can't see the legislature passing anything or referring it to the voters. And it's just such an expensive state to try to get petitions signed. So I guess you'll just have to leave that to the rest of us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for this very intellectually stimulating discussion. I had a couple of observations. One is there's a breaking news that the City Council of Berkeley endorsed the Healthcare Freedom Act. That was just April Fool. Okay. Anyway, I'm originally from India. I am a physician. I came here, got my MD, PhD. I'm currently working in a forensic hospital. So it's a different type of practice compared to the concierge kind of practice. Couple of thoughts about when you mentioned California and the possibilities there. What I've observed is over time, a majority of the colleagues I work with endorse socialized medicine. So I think the greatest threat for freedom in medicine comes from within. It's, you know, if you're familiar with Ayn Rand's literature, these are the Orrin Boyles who want socialized metallurgical sciences, or these are the Peter Keatings who want socialized architecture. So to address that, what the phenomenon I'm talking about is this drift of physicians from private sector into public sector. Now, typically, the public sector physicians get paid more, artificially more, which is the nature of socialized medicine, artificially more than what they would get in a free market. Now, a certain percentage of their income, whether they want it or not, is paid as the union dues or fair share. Now, typically with these overspilling coffers, the unions are able to sponsor politicians who are going to, again, promote socialized medicine. So somehow we need to move towards the right-to-work state so that this unholy...